Very good. Let's open the book of Numbers to Numbers chapter 1. Numbers chapter 1. Before we actually get started, I'd like to do a bit of an introduction to some of the ideas that we'll come across in the book itself. The first thing that it is important to realize, and hopefully you all have your notes, that there are two censuses in the book of Numbers, the one in chapters 1 through 4 and the one in chapter 26. So the first census in the beginning of the book of Numbers concerns the first generation of Israelites who leave Egypt, right? So this is the generation that leaves Egypt, and it's a year later, 13 months actually. So this is 13 months after the Exodus from Egypt. So this is the generation that is prepared or preparing to enter the Promised Land. Okay? The second census focuses on the experiences of the second generation. Because as you know, there is conflict, a great deal of conflict and disappointment in the book of Numbers. And the first generation is not the generation to go into the Promised Land and to take possession of it. It's the second generation that does that. And so in preparation for the passage from the wilderness across the Jordan into the Promised Land, there is another census, a census of that generation which actually goes in and takes the land. So the first generation was prepared for triumph, but of course it ended in disaster. The second generation has an opportunity for greatness, but that greatness will only come if they learn from the failures of their fathers and their mothers the absolute necessity for a robust faithfulness to the Lord despite all obstacles. And by the way, those obstacles come in many forms. In the book of Numbers, we find many of those obstacles coming in the form of idolatry. And we tend to think of idolatry as golden calves and pagan practices. And of course, that is idolatry. The worship of anything apart from the one true God is idolatry. But there are many things, obviously, that interfere with our relationship with the Lord, that entice us, that tempt us, that distract us, that cause us to focus on things which are not very essential to walking in God's ways and functioning together as a community in the way that the Lord has called us to. And so there are many difficult things. For example, we'll read about the rebellion of Korach, right? I mean, he aspired to have the position in the community that Moses had. There was no overt idolatry involved in this aspiration. He simply felt like he was more qualified to lead than Moses was. Well, obviously, he was not God's choice, right? But it didn't keep him from doing a great deal of harm and turning many people, including many leaders, away from following the Lord. So in the beginning of the book of Numbers, we'll obviously talk about that when we get to it, but in the book of Numbers, we have the preparations for the conquest of the Promised Land. So chapters 1 through 10 records Israel's preparations to enter the Promised Land. And unfortunately, in chapters 11 through 25, there follows the very sad record of the repeated acts of rebellion and unbelief, punctuated by bursts of God's wrath and instances of His grace, which leads me to one of the first commentaries I want to read. This one by Rabbi John Rozov. And this is an interesting, or provides an interesting insight into the character of the book itself. Now, this commentary was written a couple of years ago when the reading of Bamidbar corresponded with Shavuot. Now, for many of you, you are aware of the fact that this is the 39th day of the counting of the Omer, the barley sheaf between Passover, or the Feast of First Fruits, and Shavuot. But of course, because our calendar is in part linked to the cycles of the moon, as well as to the cycle of the sun, right? The Jewish holidays, which fall on the same day each year according to the Jewish calendar, sometimes or often fall on different days based upon the Gregorian calendar, and so there is a discrepancy between them each year. So days in the Jewish calendar don't always fall on the same day in the Gregorian calendar, and of course we follow the Hebrew calendar when it comes to the counting of the Omer. So just keep in mind that this comment was written at a time when the reading of this portion, Bamidbar, corresponded to Shavuot, to the Feast of Pentecost in the Jewish year. And of course, something that we also do at Pentecost, not only do we celebrate the giving of the Torah and the anointing of the Spirit that Joel speaks about in his prophecy of the last days, we also read from the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth occurs at the harvest and is associated in the Hebrew calendar to Shavuot. So, he writes a comment and he entitles it, "Who Are You?" Okay? And it's a commentary on this parsha. And it begins, "Mi'at," which in Hebrew is the way of asking a woman, "Who are you?" And it comes from Ruth chapter 3, verse 9. Okay? "So asked Boaz," obviously of Ruth, at the occasion when Ruth uncovers his cloak and approaches him to redeem her. You're probably familiar with the book of Ruth, so you are aware of this story. Okay? But he goes on and says, "It is a question that every human being asks from time to time, especially on the weekend of Shavuot, of the great meeting between Israel and God on the mountain. We ask ourselves individually and as a community, who am I? Who are we? In this time and place, at this stage of our lives, as individuals, as a people, and as a nation." Of course, these are important questions to ask. And he has an interesting insight with regard to this concept or this idea of asking this question in this time and place, at this stage of our lives, because he compares the books of the Chumash, the Torah, the five books of Moses, to different stages in a person's life. "This Shabbat," he says, and of course he's referring to the Shabbat of Shavuot, "we begin the fourth book of the five books of Moses, Bamidbar. If the book of Genesis is about human and tribal origins and beginnings, mirroring childhood, and Exodus is about human freedom, representing the driving force among adolescents, and Leviticus is about the need to adjust to the rules and regulations imposed on society in order to live productively, characteristic of young adulthood, then Bamidbar is about the mid-life journey." Bamidbar is about the mid-life journey. "In this fourth book, we see that the bloom is off, the marriage between God and Israel. Doubt, disillusionment, and struggle define our people's lives. We rebel. Our faith is broken. We want to be somewhere else, anywhere else, if it brings relief and renewal. We confront our limitations. We confront our mortality. We wonder if this is all there is. We're caught in the unfettered and cruel desert, a vast wilderness of silence. Our hearts pound. The quiet thunders in our ears. We're alone and afraid. We yearn for safety and solace. The wilderness of Sinai is far more than a physical location. Bamidbar is a human wasteland where everything falls apart. We wander without a shared vision, without shared values, or shared words. Leaders of every kind attempt to lead, but no one is listening, and each is marching to the sound of his or her own drummer. Driven by fear and jealousy, ego and greed, the people are moved by basic things, hunger, thirst, lust. God's transcendence is elusive. The book is noisy, frustrating, and painful. Rabbi Eddie Feinstein has written in his work on, a men's commentary on the Torah. He writes, Bamidbar may be the world's strongest counter-revolutionary tract. It is a rebuke to all those who believe in the one cataclysmic event that will forever free humans from their chains. It is a response to those who foresee that out of the apocalypse of political or economic revolution will emerge the new man, or the new American, or the new Jew. Here is the very people who stood in the very presence of God at Sinai, who heard truth from the mouth of God, and still they are unchanged, unrepentant, chained to their fears. The dream is beyond them, and I love this line. God offers them freedom, and they clamor for meat. Right? I mean, that statement is a very powerful expression of the fact that we can have the most magnificent of spiritual experiences and still not continue in our relationship with the Lord, right? And it's tragic in some ways because spiritual experiences are precisely the kind of experiences that so many people crave, so many people look for. Right? And I'm not saying that spiritual experiences are bad. Frankly, I enjoy them as much as the next guy. But the fact of the matter is that they are no panacea. The bottom line has to do with the fact that we are all on a journey. And the more frequently we think or imagine ourselves taking this journey together, the better off we will be, right? Because the fact is, we're on a journey and we encounter many things along the way. We experience triumph and grief, triumph and tragedy. We experience good things and experience good times, and we experience difficulty and sorrow and despair, right? That's one of the lessons that we read about in the book of Bamidbar, in the wilderness. It was a difficult place for the people of Israel as they made this transition from slavery to freedom. And in fact, the generation that actually is delivered from Egypt is not the generation that enters the Promised Land with obviously, the exception of Joshua and Caleb. So out of the 603,000 men who leave Egypt, only two of them actually enter the promised land. I mean, that's a staggering statistic. The rabbi goes on to say, I am not Moses, nor has my experience been his remotely. Yet, as a congregational rabbi, I understand our greatest leader's burden of leadership. And frankly, I was a congregational rabbi for many, many years myself, and I understand the burden of leadership as well. He writes, in the course of Bamidbar, everyone in Moses' life will betray him. Miriam and Aaron, his family members, betray him, murmuring against him. His tribe rebels against him. His people betray him in the incident of the 10 spies. And finally, he says, even God betrays him when he hit the rock and lost his dream of ever entering the promised land. And of course, he takes a little, what should I call it, literary or poetic license at this point with regard to God's betrayal. Of course, God didn't betray Moses, but Moses was certainly disappointed at the fact that he was not able to enter the promised land, that God holds him back from going in and taking possession of the land because he struck the rock rather than speak to it like he was instructed. And we've talked about that in great detail. So if you're interested in understanding that passage, please, go to the website and just download that study and listen. Okay? We just don't have the time to talk about it now. So he goes on to say Numbers is a book about burdens, not blessings. Everyone has found himself in that excruciating moment when words don't work. When we try and say the right thing to heal and to help, but each word brings more hurt. Everyone has tasted the bitterness of betrayal when no one stands with us, when those who should know better stand against us. And this is very painful. When those who should know better stand against us. Everyone has felt the deep disappointment of the dream turn sour. It could have been so good. I should have turned out so differently. Where did I go wrong? Everyone has tortured himself with the torment Moses feels in Bamidbar. And that's the ultimate lesson. Listen to the Torah's wisdom. The agony, the self-doubt, and the frustration are parts of the journey through the wilderness. They're just a part of the way life works. They're a part of the journey through the wilderness. Anyone who has ever worn Moses' shoes or carried his staff knows the anguish of Bamidbar. But I know this too, he says, you are not alone. You are not the first. You are not singled out. Even though that's the way it often feels. And most of all, and this is important too, you are not finished. So, based upon this work, this book, based upon the lessons of Bamidbar, whether you are or are not a leader, you have still experienced in one form or another some of the betrayal that Moses experiences here, or some of the disappointment that the children of Israel experience in this book. And yet, we are not abandoned. We are not left on our own. We are never left on our own. In spite of the occasions in the book of Numbers where God's anger flares against his people, the fact of the matter is that anger is always modified or mediated by his great love for his people. The fact is God loves his people, and And he is faithful to preserve them, faithful to deliver them, right? So this idea is an important one, because no matter what you are or have experienced, no matter in what ways you've been disappointed, it doesn't matter what you struggle with. And I'm not attempting by any means to trivialize those things that we are forced to struggle with. But the fact of the matter is that they are a normal part of the journey through the wilderness. And so we shouldn't think of those occasions as times when the Lord has abandoned us or turned away from us. The fact of the matter is we are not done with what God has called us to. The tortuous route, he goes on to say, through the wilderness does not come to an end. There was hope for Moses, and there is hope for us. And even though Moses doesn't enter the promised land in the book of Joshua, he is in the promised land in the Gospels. I don't know if you've ever given that some thought, but the fact is, when Yeshua is transfigured in the Gospels, right, on Mount Hermon, he appears with Elijah and Moses. Mount Hermon is in the promised land. Okay? At any rate, this article goes on. Where does hope come in? Where does hope come in? And of course, this is a question that we have all asked at one point or another. And the answer, in the turning of the heart, the turning of a page, the discovery of shared values, shared purpose, a shared life, a shared listening, and shared doing. In Deuteronomy, the fifth and the last of the five books of Moses, which represents our senior years when we begin to integrate who we are and rediscover our greater purpose, we'll hear, Shema Yisrael, listen, O Israel. In Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, words return, and we're able to share as a people in listening to God's voice and to each other. In this, there is hope yet to come. Okay? So, let me continue, if I may. In the end of the book of Numbers, that's when, well, we almost can think of it as a part two, book of Numbers part one, first generation, book of Numbers part two, because in the last section of the book of Numbers, chapters 26 through 36, that records the story of Israel's preparations to enter the promised land. So it's like a sequel to part one, and it also begins with the taking of a census. Okay, so with that, let's turn to chapter 1, verse 1. We're not going to get very far. I hope you've come to appreciate that this cycle through the Torah is about insights, not covering territory. But in this passage in chapter 1, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came up out of Egypt. So, 13 months after the Exodus is when this story takes place, and he is told to take a census of the whole Israelite community, every person in the community, and they are all supposed to be listed by name, one by one. You and Aaron are to number by their divisions all the men in Israel, 20 years old or more, who are able to serve in the army. One man from each tribe, each the head of his family, is to help you. Right? So they undertake this great census to number the people of Israel, 20 years old and older. And we obviously find out that they are numbered based upon their age and ability to be mustered in Israel's army, right? The biblical equivalent to the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. Okay? So these are men who are capable of going to war. So the Lord speaks to Moses in verse 1. He speaks about the setting apart of the people in chapter 1:1 through chapter 10:10. In chapters 1 through 4 is the census of the first generation, the muster, and the command of the Lord, right? The instruction that the Lord gives in the form of a command to number the people. And this expression occurs frequently in the Torah. The Lord commanded Moses saying, or spoke to Moses saying. Okay? So, it also mentions that this occurs in the desert of Sinai. Well, at this point, the Jewish people have been situated in the desert for 13 months throughout the whole book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, and part of the book of Shemot, right? In fact, right, the Jewish people leave Egypt in Exodus chapter 12. So most of the book of Exodus occurs in the desert, and all of the book of Leviticus occurs in the desert, and they're still in the desert. Right? They've been in the desert for over a year. So why does the text tell us they're in the desert? Right? It's like, okay. And of course, there's a reason why the text tells us we're in the desert, but what is added to our knowledge? You know, it's like, tell me something I don't know. We've been in the desert for a long time now. Right? So the answer to the question lies in the fact that we always read Parshat Bamidbar before Shavuot. It always is read just, you know, a couple of weeks, sometimes corresponding with Shavuot. According to the Shulchan Aruch, which is a monumental commentary on the Torah, there is a footnote that explains it. Okay? Before we experience the giving of the Torah once again for spirituality, the Torah is given anew every Shavuot. So, just like on Passover, we're all supposed to appreciate or understand or think of ourselves as if we personally were called by God out of Egypt, every Shavuot we look at as a giving or a providing of the Torah. In other words, the Torah wasn't provided by God 3,500 years ago, although that is obviously true. But God wants us to think of ourselves as if we were standing among that company at Mount Sinai and receiving the Torah as one of the people to whom it was given, right? So there is a certain lesson connected to that concept. It is necessary to recall and take to heart the fact that the Torah was not given in a civilized environment, but in a desert. Okay? A desert is a place of desolation. By the way, in the wilderness, Bamidbar, in the wilderness in Israel, there are sandy sections, but it's not sandy, typically. It's not a sand dune desert like the Sahara, but it's a very rugged, desolate place where, according to Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 6, no one lives. Okay? Thus, the Torah was given there to indicate that it should be embraced without any preconceptions or ulterior motives. And this is such an important idea, because we all, no exceptions, we all filter in information, the information we receive through our senses, the information we receive as a result of talking with someone or reading a book, all of the information that we receive, in whatever way we receive it, we filter through our paradigm, our world view, right? And so our paradigm is responsible for the way we understand and interpret information, right? This concept is incredibly, incredibly important, especially when it concerns the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai in the wilderness. Because the very nature of the giving of the Torah is such that it defies preconditions. It defies ulterior motives. It defies a cultural bias. That's the whole point, according to the rabbis. When a person lives in a civilized place and he encounters a new idea or suggestion, he will first evaluate it to determine whether or not it is acceptable according to the social norms or whatever paradigm shapes his or her world view. I talk so frequently about the difference between the Jewish and Greek world views, right? But someone whose worldview is Greek doesn't think of themselves as having a Greek or a Western worldview. They just do. They filter whatever information they receive about the world through that perspective. And they don't even realize they're doing it until, you know, they confront the differences, and there are vast differences between the way Jews in biblical times looked at life and the way the Greeks in biblical times looked at life, and in fact still do, right? The Western mindset is shaped by Greek philosophical models, and it's incredibly important to appreciate those differences in order to help us come to terms with what the Bible really says. I have a whole seminar on this. It's called The Essentials. Okay? But going back to our commentary, with Torah, however, this would be a mistake. What would be a mistake? To filter the words of the Torah through our paradigm, through our Western paradigm or Oriental paradigm. The fact is, it was written by Jews. So the only way to really understand it is by appreciating its significance based upon a Hebrew worldview, a Jewish worldview. Okay? At any rate, apprehending the Torah through any other perspective than the one it was given through would be a mistake. The correct approach to accepting the Torah is, quote, we will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey, and later we will understand. In the Bible, obedience comes first, then understanding comes. The Torah was given in a desert where nobody lives to indicate that one needs to be truly open-minded, and I would say instead open-hearted. Right? Of course, he's writing to a Western audience, so he uses the expression open-minded, but in Hebrew, it would be open-hearted. That is, not influenced by one's environment to appreciate its values. And we are often influenced by our environment, often influenced by our culture, and in fact, biblical figures are influenced by their culture as well. And I cite Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 through 13 here as an example or an occasion when Peter, right, he's fellowshipping with Gentiles in Galatia, some brothers from Jerusalem come, they show up, and they are among those who feel that Jews and Gentiles really should not fellowship together or eat a meal together. And what does Peter do? He withdraws, right? And many people withdraw with him. And Peter is simply, he's simply influenced by by what he perceives to be the attitude on the part of the others who come, and he acts in ways which are completely inappropriate. And of course, Paul nails him publicly for his hypocrisy, right? I've talked a great deal about this idea too, so I don't want to belabor the point. I only cite this example as a way of demonstrating that we are all influenced in one way or another by whatever culture and community we're connected to. But the fact of the matter is that in order to really hear the words of the Torah, we have to hear them with an open heart, right? An open heart. The Torah was given in the desert to teach that sharing the Torah with those who currently find themselves in a spiritual desert is fundamental to Torah Judaism. So not only should we hear the Torah without the distractions of our Western culture, we need to appreciate the fact that the Torah is something that God wants communicated to everyone who finds themselves in a spiritual desert, right? So it's not just for the Jewish people. The Torah is for the Gentiles as well. In fact, it is not the case that the Torah can also reach those who are found in a spiritual wasteland. To the contrary, this is the central theme of the giving of the Torah, to transform every spiritual desert into a civilized environment. And of course, this includes the idea of tikkun olam, repairing the world. But the rabbis asked the question, you know, why did God give the Torah to the Jewish people in Sinai rather than in the Promised Land? And the answer is because it was not just intended for Israel. It was intended for all mankind. That's why it was given in the desert, in a quiet place, in a place without distraction, without noise, right? And of course, it's important that we sometimes go to a quiet place so that we can really hear what it has to say. I've already talked about the fact that it was given on the first day of the second month, that it occurs 13 months after the Exodus. Israel had spent the previous year in the region of Mount Sinai receiving the Torah, erecting the tabernacle, and becoming a people. Now Israel was to be mustered as a military force and formed into a cohesive nation to provide the basis for an orderly march to the Promised Land. Okay? So, now comes the idea of a census. Take a census. According to Rashi, because the people of Israel are so precious to the Lord, so precious to God. But I'd like to read a comment from Tanhuma, a Midrash, and it's explained in the footnote below. The Jewish people were counted on 10 occasions, once when they went down to Egypt, once when they departed from Egypt, once in the beginning of the book of Numbers, once in connection with the spies, once in the days of Joshua, when the land was divided, twice in the days of Shaul, once in the days of David, once in the days of Ezra, and once in the future to come. And this passage with regard to the future days to come is interesting because it's based on a text in Jeremiah chapter 33 that goes on, obviously, to speak of the new covenant that God will make with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. And there's one interesting section in this passage in verse 14. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the gracious promise I have made to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. Right? So, in spite of the many difficulties we experience in the wilderness, God intends to accomplish his purpose in us and to fulfill his promises to his people. And in the previous verse, it speaks of the restoration of the people of Israel to the land it speaks of them once again as the flock of God. And it speaks of them as passing under the hand of the one who counts them. Right? Another of the numberings. Okay? Let me read another commentary. This one by Rabbi Abigail Treo. It's entitled Bamidbar and the Omer. I've already mentioned the Omer, the counting of the Omer, the counting of the sheaf that is waved before the Lord, right, on the Feast of First Fruits, and then we count 50 days to Shavuot. A counting of people and time. And she begins her article with a line or the words from one of the songs of the musical Rent. 525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year? The question asked in the chorus of Seasons of Love, made ever more poignant by the tragic death of its composer-lyricist Jonathan D. Larson, just months before Rent opened on Broadway in 1996, has been rattling lately in my mind, she says. After all, we are doing an awful lot of counting this week. We count the final days of the Omer, and as our parsha begins, take the census of the Israelite community. What does all this counting have to do with the ways in which we measure what really matters? First, the counting of the Omer, which culminates in Shavuot this weekend, it is deceptively simple. All you have to do is count every night, increasing the count by one each day, and at the end you'll have reached Shavuot, a seemingly mundane mitzvah. The blessing over which is nothing more than praising God for the command to count. Not very complicated. And yet, it is for many one of the most difficult mitzvot to keep. Who among us remembers to count it without fail every night? Somehow not a year goes by without a slip up. It turns out that counting days is not so easy after all. One of the many differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Second Temple era rivals, had to do with this counting. The Pharisees observed Shavuot on the 50th day after the first day of Passover, as we, their halachic heirs, do as well. The Sadducees, on the other hand, celebrated Shavuot on the 7th Sunday after Passover. Their disagreement had nothing to do with how many days to count. That was made clear in Leviticus 23, which instructs us to count 7 weeks, the day after which would be day 50, Shavuot. According to Louis Finkelstein, the disagreement had to do with when the counting began. And from the day on which you bring the sheaf of elevation offering, the day after the Sabbath, you shall count off 7 weeks. So, the beginning of this cycle is determined by the word Sabbath. Does it refer to the weekly Sabbath, or does it refer to the Sabbath, the holiday Sabbath of the Feast of Unleavened Bread? The Pharisees took it to mean the holiday Sabbath of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Sadducees took it to mean after the weekly Sabbath, right? At any rate, this is the instruction from the book of Leviticus. It is a seemingly clear instruction, but what does the Sabbath here really mean? Does it refer to the first day of Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or to the first Sabbath after that holiday? When, in other words, are you supposed to start counting? The abstract intellectual argument over linguistics becomes one of the more practical differences separating the two communities that they lived out their interpretations. Counting, knowing when to start and how long to keep it going, matters a great deal. This brings us to the second kind of counting we are doing this week. What is the point of God's instructing Moses to take a census at the outset of the Israelites' wanderings? Having been given the laws at Sinai in Exodus, with further instructions in Leviticus, the Israelites cannot move forward on their journey until a count of the people takes place. For many learners, these census lists make up the least interesting passages of the Chumash. Long and linguistically repetitive, the list of men according to their tribes totals 603,550 in Numbers chapter 1, verse 46. But if you've read this passage, you notice that the number of representatives from each tribe is stated in the exact same language. And of course, there is an explanation for it, which I have offered in the past. But between the Omer, she goes on to say, and the census, we are counting this week our two most precious commodities, time and people. That both are impossible to count is a token of their importance. They are the foundation stones of our lives. It is a cognitive, spiritual struggle to bring them into proper focus, to keep them in their rightful place at the center of our attention. This section is quite compelling. 50 days will have soon passed since we celebrated our freedom around the Seder table. Where did those days go? And what did we do that really mattered during those 7 weeks? We head into our next holiday reading a parsha that pauses to count people before recommencing the narrative story of their lives. With whom have we spent these days? As Larson asked, how do we measure a year? Albert Einstein famously quipped, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything worth counting counts. With all the numbers and counting pervading our week, let us not lose sight of the message they bring, that what counts the most is spending time with one another, and that we measure our years by counting day in and day out the moments we spend with others wandering with us, blazing paths together through the wilderness of life, right? I know that you struggle with this in the same way that I do, because I so frequently wonder what happened to the time, right? In fact, I think about it now more than ever, right? My daughter will be married next weekend. I sometimes think of the little girl she was 33 years ago. And I think of my son and his wife and the fact that they now have a child of their own, right? In fact, he was just a year old yesterday. And yesterday, when I texted them a happy birthday, right? I thought to myself, wow, what happened to this past year? Where did it go? And of course, you think about the times that you spend together with the people that you love or spend time doing the things that you love. And that's when you appreciate, especially during a portion that speaks of the value or the importance of counting both time and people, just how valuable time and people are. Or maybe it would be better to say, should be, in our lives, right? And so, it's obviously important that we use our time wisely, that we spend our time wisely, that we spend time with the people who matter to us, and we spend time doing things that count, right? every one of us has heard others talk about this and say these very words frequently. But what does it take for us to really appreciate the significance of this lesson? Right? That, of course, ultimately boils down to an idea we talked about a few minutes ago, the idea of being open-hearted. Okay? One last idea that I'd like to discuss quickly. In chapter 3, I know we're skipping a lot, chapter 3, verse 44, the Lord also said to Moses, take the Levites in place of all the firstborn of Israel. So, this is one of those passages where the tribe of Levi is taken in the place of Israel's firstborn, right? And so it's an explanation for why the tribe of Levi and the descendants of Aaron, in this case, are the priests in the community and not the firstborn sons. Take the Levites in place of all the firstborn of Israel and the livestock of the Levites in place of their livestock. The Levites are to be mine, God says. I am the Lord. Okay? Now, there are some other passages which I'd like to allude to. The first is in Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 through 2. The Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn male. The first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether human or animal, God says, right? And of course, that communicates the idea that every firstborn male belongs to the Lord, and it is assumed, and we'll read a comment in a few minutes about this, that the firstborn male was intended or supposed to be the priestly representative of each family at the tabernacle and later, obviously, at the temple. But there was an occasion when the people turn from God, right? The people engage in idolatry. There is an occasion in the book of Exodus, in chapter 32, when Moses comes down from the mountain and the women from the camp of Midian had come into the Israelite camp and had enticed the men to engage in sexual acts of idolatry. So the people of Israel engage in idolatry, right? And Moses saw, in verse 25 of chapter 32 of the book of Exodus, the people were running wild, and that Aaron had let them get completely out of control and had so become a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And it says that all the Levites rallied to him. And then he told them, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor. And of course, he's referring to those engaged in idolatry. Right? And of course, it goes on in this text to say that the Levites did as Moses commanded. And that day, about 3,000 people died. 3,000 of the total company or community of people who had engaged in these lascivious acts of idolatry, right? But because of the zeal of Pinchas and the other Levites who considered God as opposed to their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and fathers and mothers, they are rewarded with the everlasting priesthood. And so the Levites are taken in the place of the firstborn. And in Numbers chapter 3, this issue comes up again, because in verse 6, God says, bring the tribe of Levi and present them to Aaron, the priest, to assist him. So the entire tribe of Levi is now presented to Aaron that they might assist him in the work associated with the tabernacle. The entire tribe of Levi are not priests, but they are or do participate in the work of the tabernacle. And in verse 11 and 12 of this chapter, God says, I have taken the Levites from among the Israelites in place of the first male offspring of every Israelite woman. The Levites are mine, for all the firstborn are mine. But that's why the firstborn have to be redeemed, because they belong to God. And since the Levites take their place in their service to the sanctuary, those firstborn sons have to be purchased back or bought back, and that's why the ceremony of the redemption of the firstborn is mentioned. This comes up in Numbers chapter 8. Now, something else that comes up is in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, and it speaks of Reuben. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, and it says in chapter 5, verse 1, he was the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph. This has nothing to do with the priesthood. This has to do with the rights of the inheritance, right? When Reuben sinned by defiling his father's marriage bed, his rights as the firstborn sons, his rights vis-a-vis the inheritance, were given to Joseph, taken from Reuben and given to Joseph. This has nothing to do with the priesthood. Obviously, the tribe of Joseph does not become the priests. The tribe of Levi is the tribe of priests because of the zeal of the tribe of Levi and because they had a heart. They were zealous for God, right? More zealous for God than they were for any other consideration, okay? So, one final comment. The institution of the office of the priesthood was God's gracious provision for a people at a distance from him who needed one to appear in the divine presence in their behalf. The high priest was to act for men in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. He was the mediator who ministered for the guilty. The high priest represented the whole people. All Israelites were reckoned as being in him. The prerogative held by him belonged to the whole of them. But on this account, it was transferred to him, to Aaron, because it was impossible that all Israelites should keep themselves holy and become the priests of the Lord. And then, of course, I have a reference here to the passage in the book of Exodus that speaks of the priesthood of the entire people of Israel. So the entire people of Israel are priests in terms of their outreach to the nations, right? But within the tribe itself, the tribe of Levi was set apart by God, and the family of Aaron were made the priests. And I apologize, but finally, this last comment, Pidyon HaBen, the redemption of the firstborn son takes place when a baby is at least 31 years old and involves buying him back from a Kohen. In actual practice, there are various exemptions, which mean that many families do not require a Pidyon HaBen. The background for this mitzvah is somewhat complex, but here goes. Originally, God intended for the firstborn of each Jewish family to be a Kohen. That is, that family's representative to the Holy Temple. But then came the incident of the golden calf. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai and smashed the tablets, he issued everyone an ultimatum. Make your choice, either God or the idol. Only the tribe of Levi came to the side of God. At that point, God decreed that each family's firstborn would forfeit their Kohen status, and henceforth, all the Kohanim would come from the tribe of Levi. And I apologize, the earlier reference to Exodus 32 has to do with the incident of the golden calf. Okay? Which brings us to the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen, since the firstborn child is technically a Kohen, whose potential cannot be actualized, he has to be replaced, so to speak, by a Kohen from the tribe of Levi. This is accomplished by the father of the baby offering the Kohen a redemptive value of 5 silver coins for the boy. A deeper reason we perform this mitzvah is to remind us of the exodus from Egypt when God killed the Egyptian firstborn, yet spared the Jewish firstborn. Also, since a person loves his own firstborn so much, it is fitting to re-acknowledge the fact that everything we own, in fact, belongs to God. Okay? So, with that, we'll conclude today's study. It was great to have you with us. By the way, Wanda writes that Charlene is experiencing a power outage. Just for your information, after the studies are complete, it takes a little time for WizIQ to process them. But the studies are available the same day. I don't know if it takes about like 20 or 30 minutes. Shortly after the studies are concluded, you can go to the upcoming events page at ashavbooks.org and click on the link. And if you've missed the live broadcast, shortly after the live broadcast is completed, you can click on that same link and it will replay. Okay, the recording will replay. Now, how long it's available, I can't answer that question. I'd have to talk with my webmaster, right? But I do know it's available immediately after the study. Okay? Pretty soon after the study. Very good. Any other comments or questions? Yes. The gospel studies are also available right after the recording is concluded or soon after the recording is concluded, okay? But I'm not sure for how long, okay? Yes, Monica. Yes, Yeshua followed the calendar of the Pharisees, the halakha of the Pharisees. That's correct, right? So we know, for example, in the year that he died, that he celebrated Passover one day before it was celebrated officially according to the Sadducean calendar. So, the Pharisees begin the counting of the Omer on the Feast of First Fruits, the day after the holiday Sabbath of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, regardless of what day of the week it happens to fall upon, right? So that would have been the reckoning that Yeshua used when counting the Omer. By the way, the blessing for the counting of the Omer is very simple. You can find the blessing at Chabad.org or you can find it in my Haggadah. In the back of the Haggadah, right? The book we use to celebrate Passover is a section on the Feast of First Fruits. And it includes an explanation of the counting of the Omer, the way it's counted, the blessings that you recite, and the way to count the Omer. Today, by the way, is 39 days. This is 39 days of the Omer. So, we are only a few days away from Shavuot, right? So, we are already at 3 weeks, 5 weeks, and 4 days, right? And of course, we're counting to 7. So we are almost there. So, We count the Omer after nightfall. So I would encourage you to remember to count the Omer tonight. Today is 39 days, so tonight is obviously at sunset. Tonight will be the next day in the cycle. Okay? So I don't want to count it because we're not counting it. I want to count it later after the Sabbath is over and it's sunset, and I'll say the blessing and I'll count the next day of the Omer, which has not happened yet. Okay? Very good. Roderick writes, Yeshua says in Matthew that the one who teaches Torah to others is the greatest in the kingdom. Is that an idiom? No, I don't think it's an idiom. I think it's an expression regarding how important it is to teach Torah. And by the way, the idea of being greatest in the kingdom, we don't use that expression in the way that Westerners do. To be the greatest in the kingdom, according to a Western perspective, would be to be greater than everyone else who is in the kingdom. Right? I mean, that's kind of what it means by definition. From a Western perspective, if you are the greatest in the kingdom, then you are greater than everyone else in the kingdom. In Hebrew, it just means that you will be great, not greater or greatest. Because, frankly, that's really not an objective we should aspire to, right? Yeshua makes a comment that that's what the Gentiles aspire to. And we shouldn't be like that. We should think of ourselves as the servants of others. So, the concept of being great or greatest in the kingdom means to be in the kingdom. It means to be connected to God in such a way that means we will enter the Olam Haba. Right? And, of course, based upon the value that Yeshua places on the Torah, that's why it's expressed in these terms. Right? In other words, it's a good thing, a noble thing, a worthwhile thing to observe the Torah and to teach others to observe it too. Right? Even though none of us observes it completely or perfectly. Very good. Shabbat Shalom. May the Lord be with you and keep you. And Lord willing, we will see you on Thursday night. Lehitraot. May the Lord anoint you and bless your week. Shabbat Shalom.